Welcome to the Modern Masculinity Podcast, where we delve into the depths of what it means to be a man in today's world, and we explore the real-life challenges and triumphs that you and I face every single day. My name is Hector Santi Esteban, and I come with no answers, only questions for some of the most wise, insightful, and grounded men that I know. So get settled in. You're listening to Modern Masculinity. Fellas, what's going on? It's great to have you here. I'm honored, humbled that you're here, grateful to be a part of your journey, and excited for you to join us for another conversation. And today, it's one that maybe is a little more philosophical. We get a little more deep on this one, and it's with Mike Skripnik. And he's someone who's been doing the work for a long time. I got thrown into this world of men's work, and it was really born out of my own challenges. And similarly, Mike might have had his own, but he's made it his life to dedicate to finding some of these answers. And he brought him here today. And it's a really cool conversation. We got to go all over the board to figure out what was it like before, where are we now, and how the hell did we get here? And more importantly, how can men leverage that as an opportunity? I felt before that we were against all odds and that we had these unfair circumstances. And perhaps that is true. But if nothing else, it makes for an exciting underdog story, which I think we're all going to be a part of. So enough of me, y'all. Let me get out of the way. Let's get into today's episode with Mr. Mike Skripnik. Mike, welcome to the Modern Masculinity Podcast. How are you, my man?
Hector, I'm doing pretty dang awesome, if I do say so. We've had some interesting weather.
Yeah, we're recording this right now, January 15th.
I don't want to timestamp it so much, but we had some power outages today, so.
It's an important thing for a couple of reasons. First off, I'm here in Southern California, so when we say we're freezing, we're not actually freezing. There are plenty of people who are actually freezing, so I want to honor that. But also to say that I think the cold creates an interesting set of circumstances. I was just watching somebody who follow. And she was saying when things get cold and start snowing in her area, the whole town shuts down. There's no activities. There's really nothing to do. Everybody bunkers down. And she said, you can either use that time to start scrolling and you can just use it as a mindless time. Or what she was doing is she was going into the forest, reconnecting with herself. And it was just an interesting thing. We don't experience it to that extent here in Southern California, but there is a shift that happens when it gets colder. And it definitely seems to be a time that's a bit more reflective, at least.
I would say that the benefit of where I am now versus where I grew up. I moved from busy city to an area in between a busy city and a beautiful resort. And so it's tremendously fewer people, 25,000 versus 1.2 million. And invest our time is my pace, is my acceptance of when things don't go right. It's just the similar approach as the fact that I walk and ride a bike about 100 times more than in the city. And I plan my day around the breaks versus the other way around. I always would spend so much time trying to be as productive as humanly possible and get things in. And if things didn't go right, then it's on to the next thing. Or you couldn't use the power, so it'd be on to be a meeting. Like you'd go to the meeting then. Now it's just use the time in a way that suits the day and suits your framework or frame of mind. And if you're in a productive mode, then it's going to be doing work. But if you weren't to begin with, use it as a reprieve. Use the proverbial snow day as the snow day, and like we used to when we were kids.
Take me into your world, Mike. One of the first things that we always like to do is to talk about the things that a lot of guys don't like to talk about, which is the things that are going on. There's that classic joke. Right? Somehow it made its way around onto a meme where the guy's out playing with his buddy and that just went through a big life change or a divorce. I don't remember what the change was, but the wife's like, what is he doing or where is he working? And the guy's, I don't know, we didn't talk about it. Like the real life stuff didn't come up because that hasn't been guy culture. This show is an attempt to start providing some solidarity through these things. And even amidst a world that is great and fantastic, I gotta imagine that there are still some things or challenges that you're working through. Take us into your world a little bit and help us to understand how even someone like you who has an incredible life that I think a lot of us aspire to, how there's still some work that's involved with that.
It was poignant that we began the conversation with a bit of a conversation about the weather. And then you alluded to what the wife was asking when the husband or the partner comes back with no information that is useful to her. We men tend to want to communicate in the surface. We feel it's safer. It's more comfortable. There's no risk in it. And that comfort, in fact, is based on the fact that we don't have to reveal anything. So we can keep people at a distance. And when you think about that, weather, sport, basic news, not getting ingrained into our belief system. systems immediately is a great place to stand off from each other. It's like looking across the field at each other. That's how we communicate to keep the distance. That is what I consider to be some of the most uncomfortable conversations, even though we believe we've convinced ourselves that it's the comfortable conversation. And when I say that, it's the avoidance of a deeper conversation, deeper connection. If we were to reveal for a moment that we had worries or concerns, or we were challenged by something, or even if we were overly optimistic and excited about something, we will assess it. So my world is looking at that and going, so we're assessing it for the risk it might bring if we were to share how we feel, good or bad, challenged or not, with another man or men, and somehow that will deliver more risk than the moment that we keep it at the surface and we don't share. And so I find that an interesting, how would you say it? It's in conflict with what you would immediately suggest a way to engage with. So how do we form connections? How do we form bonds? How do we form community? It's because we share at a level where people realize that we're all the same. And in order to do that, we have to share being vulnerable in that way. And our first intention is to completely do the opposite. And yet when you ask someone, we answer immediately, oh, you just share with how you feel, talk about your family. It's the whole, I feel comfortable in a neighborhood because I can walk out in my pajamas. And when you're at that level, you are comfortable. You believe there's no risk in that exercise. And where I reside in life presently is trying to help men understand that we can get there quickly. We can go deep quickly. We can have a vulnerable conversation. And the risk that we perceive is always bigger than the risk that actually reveals itself, which is typically very little or none. There are not many times that men actually vulnerable when open, when expressing themselves in a personal conversation, in a personal way, in business or personal environments. The risk that you worry about ever rears its head. We usually don't get slapped in the face for it in terms of by the reality of the situation. We usually don't get laid out in terms of our professional careers. We don't lose our stuff, if you will. And we certainly don't risk our families by being more open. And that world in there allows us, when we finally do reduce the perception of risk, give men the opportunity to operate in that risk-free space, we get to the heart of it. And we get to a place where men actually feel better. And that's because they start talking. There's so much to be said about the male experience of talking, communicating. I actually bought in very heavily, and it's for no lack of evidence, but generally men prefer being shoulder to shoulder when talking. I always felt comfortable in an environment around a table, around a boardroom table, around a room, around a kitchen table, around a dinner table, looking people square in the face and assessing my circumstances. I found that was the best way to communicate. This concept, even though we do generally prefer to be shoulder to shoulder doing things, the reality is it doesn't break down to the level of deep communication, authenticity. You tend not to get right to the point when you're not looking someone in the eye. It's another act of avoidance.
Yeah, I heard Chris Williamson mention that they did a study, and what they found is that they actually did what you were talking about, and they found that the conversations didn't develop. Mike, you bring up a couple of interesting points, and one of them is this idea of being able to connect with other guys. And Chris Williamson mentioned a study recently on his podcast where he talked about they got guys together and they put them in a traditional setting or at tables or across from each other. And they found that they actually found the opposite, that they didn't go as deep. And what was interesting is that they didn't just sit them in a circle, but what they did is they gave them something to do. It's like fixing an engine or something like that, where they allowed the guys to be in a circle and start having this alternative objective. And then all of a sudden, when that started to go on autopilot, is when the deeper connection started to happen. By giving them some sort of purpose together, that was what created the connection. And that's why I think that things like sports teams or the military or the softball, the Thursday softball beer league, right? Like that same sort of thing where guys have a shared common purpose. And within that, they're able to build those bonds that allow that deeper sense of connection and authenticity. Perhaps.
It's an interesting reality. And what I always wonder, and I've experienced it, I've never had a shortage of conversations that went to the heart of things with men where we had nothing else going on around us than I've had in the last few years. Prior to that, all my interactions with men at a deeper level were in the scenarios you described, if they were something that I felt connected to. I find that a curious result. And why I think that is the collective of working on one project looks at that project. So actually, let me just rewind it a bit. You notice I use the word risk. And I use that word a lot when it comes to men and how we communicate. And I've adopted the premise of a risk-free or a low-risk space. We constantly hear the idea of a safe space. And that definitely was a more feminine construct, because most women will say at some point throughout the day, almost every day, they feel unsafe, or there's a moment where they don't feel safe. There are not a lot of men generally that would suggest that they don't feel safe, but there's definitely men who will, and I would say on a regular basis, feel that there might be risk for them in that moment, right? And the difference is men generally don't feel unsafe walking down the street. We don't physically feel unsafe. We don't feel threatened by anything, and we don't feel like anyone's going to hurt us or accost us generally. But we do feel that if we act a certain way, we risk being embarrassed. If we act a certain way, we risk losing the deal. If we act a certain way, we risk losing that relationship. Those things tend to bubble up for us. So when we perceive that the risk is low, or the risk is shared, as in a team situation or a collaborative situation, we then strip away that concern and allow ourselves to be more vulnerable because someone's got our back, or we perceive that our back is not at risk. At least we're going to be able to face on whatever's coming. So I find that it's an interesting scenario of how I viewed men. I've had a lot of challenges with how I view relationships with men in some ways, and that is I've always been able to get along with them at that rudimentary level. I never was able to get along with them in that personal level for a sustained period of time and then maintain the relationship. In the last few years of my life, it's constant, going deep immediately to learn more, to share more, to be more authentic, and rising back up to the surface is a simple exercise that bonds you in a way that maintains contact, that builds community, and maintains connection. And it's possible that might be unique to me, but interfacing with other men, I find many men are not struggling, but demand, are absolutely wanting and needing these connections at a different level.
Yeah, it's interesting because I swung too far, right? I'm a person of poles in the sense that shut everything down, pack everything in, pretend nothing happened, no emotions. That's what I grew up. That was my automatic state, if you will, that I came out with. Then it was like, oh, okay, we've got to be in touch. We've got swung back the other way and realized that it was like getting into a car and not knowing how fast the car could go or not knowing how to steer. All of a sudden be getting in there and realizing it's going all these different ways. I remember coming back from a dad's group event. I'm part of the Front Row Dads, and they had a live event last year. And I remember coming back and we did a lot of breath work and a lot of getting in touch with what was going on. And I was thinking that I was going to be this Zen, this Buddhic calm person. I came back and I was so much more angry. I was so much more pissed off. And part of it was that there was a lot of stuff that was coming up that I hadn't dealt with. But also the other part of it was that now that you are allowing and being authentic, there's some guardrails or there's some learning that comes with being in touch with your emotion, being authentic. There are some do's, don't. I don't know. Maybe you can speak to where I'm going, but that, I just think it's a word of caution because I think maybe I came in too early in the movement where there wasn't enough of this masculine state behind it. And I suffered a lot of the repercussions from it.
We have to understand that communicating at any time requires a significant degree of emotional awareness. It may be coined emotional intelligence, but I think it's really emotional awareness. And that is being aware of your interactions with others and how your interactions with yourself correlate. That, know thyself and know others. And when we believe that there's like a socialist acceptance, especially when you go away for these weekends, I tend to navigate and gravitate rather to the middle. I'm a common man. I want to say that. I want to say I'm a voice for the men that the 70% of the men in the middle who don't feel that the edges are where they resonate with. Not going out to a field into the woods and bump banging drums. Not going into a hug circle. It's not men generally feel that some of the extremes of the movement of masculinity or becoming more feminine in your ways or grasping your femininity, that pushes them away. They don't recognize it. It's not what they're comfortable with. And if men are just generally not comfortable with that, they won't gravitate to it. So let's get back to the conversation. So you go to away for a weekend, regardless of what the setting is, as it's extremes or even in the middle, you have a group of 100 people or 10 people or 300 people, 1,000 people who all accept that the language of that weekend or day is the same. The acceptance of that vulnerability is the same. That comfort level is the same. And you walk out and you expect that the next person you talk to, you can just dump the reality and your truth on. And at the same time, they're going to go, wait a second, I wasn't on that weekend. I was not only on that weekend, but I'm not ready for that weekend. And learning where and when and how to understand if your conversation, if your vulnerability is an appropriate share at that time is really key. Some people are better than others. Just simply having that awareness that what you did on that week was no different than an entrepreneur who spends a week at a mastermind or something and comes back and then dumps all their big ideas on everybody else in their staff. And everyone's, we weren't there, dude. Like, slow down. You might be excited, but we're not ready. The same is true generally for most people. Understanding where it fits, plotting into the conversation, slowly getting a feel for what people are willing to tolerate. And if they're genuinely interested, because quite frankly, someone with a tertiary interest in the conversation at first isn't interested in your authenticity. They don't care about your vulnerability. The difference between someone who's genuinely interested and someone who is not, who's just passing the time saying, yeah, how you doing? When someone really says, how are you doing? And then your response, instead of, I'm doing okay, I'm good, can then maybe be, you know what? I got some stuff. There's some things going on. You have 5 minutes. I'd love to talk with you more about it. And yeah. I've had the fortune of being in rooms with C-suite executives who basically had a revelation and then find themselves, and I don't do this and I don't ascribe to kind of get people to this moment, but there's tears. There's a revelation about what's really going on when they're like, I can't help it. I'm an asshole in that moment. And they go, I just can't help myself. And you go, maybe it's this. And they go, oh, I can't believe it. And then there's revelation. Sometimes those moments happen. But I've also been in the frontline worker room with the garbage men, the guys who drive the trucks and load and do the work. And we managed to sit around a table, not wrenching, but talking. And the room gets warm. It gets open. It gets vulnerable. And those men have the same revelations. And what's powerful to me is it's not about the scenario. It's not about the circumstance. It's more about the plain spokenness, the comfort that you give people, and the lack of risk they perceive. And often I find myself able to be put it out there, and then that opens the door for others to share a bit. I also find that it's not important that we get to everybody's secrets. And it's certainly not something I recommend in any of the groups that I ever speak with either, is I don't want someone to stand up and go, my mom beat the hell out of me for all my life and I resent her and that's why I hate women. Like, whatever. Like, I don't need that to happen in those moments. I'm not the psychologist. I do need a man to recognize that what has happened to him is affecting others and him today. So what happened to him in the past is affecting him and others today. And when we figure that out, when we make that connection and get that, the eyes just light up and they go, oh, wow, I can't believe that might be a thing. Then we can find a path to helping them uncover that. And I don't mean helping in the way that everybody needs healing. Maybe we all do. In the way that we can then go on a journey of discovery to understand what it is that affected us, what happened to us, and how that's connected to the things that we do today. And there's as much positive in that as negative. The good things that happen to us, things that reinforce behaviors, become as embedded as the negative things to keep us from hurting ourselves or protecting our stuff or preserving our lives. Those things are all wired in so that we can basically procreate and pass on our genes. And this is wiring that is millions of years old. It's in our DNA. It's billions of years since our DNA existed. So unwiring it and thinking that our modern day society deserves a whole new look, and why doesn't it just happen the way we want it to, is a bit naive. And so we have to work with what we've got, and how do we do that in an effective way? It's to understand that sometimes this stuff is connected. It's not so bad that someone brought it up as an idea that maybe we should investigate. And the simple ways to go about getting that help or treatment or care or non-therapeutic interventions that are out there in life can fix and redirect and reposition us. It's just a simple conversation. It doesn't take much. And everything doesn't have to be a Netflix special.
You bring up a lot of good points. And one of the big things that I've found from this show is that fame seems to be really plaguing, for sure, me. But I would imagine that that's extended to a lot of people my age, because there's such a defined way to how to act. It seems, and I could be wrong, but I grew up in the 90s. It seems like in the 80s, there was a little more room for a rebel or a rough and tumble or someone to draw a little outside the lines. And I was just thinking this morning that I went to a Catholic school for 16 years of my life. And so I've got that kind of embedded in me. But there was a very specific way to act. And anything outside of that act, of acting that way, was cause for shame. And I never realized how much I carried around of that. I guess they talk about like the Catholic guilt, right, or the Catholic shame, but it's this thing that you carry around that you inherently are not good, that there's something wrong with you, right? And I think, I don't know how much people are familiar, but there's that concept of like original sin built into Catholicism, that like you are not enough. And I think that guys, they carry that around. And and they go, oh, because this thing happened, or because I felt this way, or because whatever, that there's this not enoughness that they assign and ascribe to themselves, that it's just not based in anything true. It's based in their shame. And the thing with shame is that it thrives in secrecy. Bringing that stuff to light, all of a sudden that shame starts to lose its power. And that's what I feel happens when guys are able to be authentic around other guys, specifically other guys, because they're able to bring that shame to light and realize, oh, we're all going through the same thing.
Guilt and shame, very cohabiting bedfellows. Both are related to what we either did or didn't do. The point of shame becomes things that would be society wouldn't accept, right? It goes against the mores of society. Shame happens to be in a darker place where not only did you act a certain way or not act a certain way, but you happened to do it in a way that was against what you would say is morally right or is controversial. Guilt is really a feeling that you didn't behave a certain way or that you did something you shouldn't. Guilt for taking something that isn't yours. Theft, sure, but not embarrassing. If you stole your dad's cigar and you smoked it, now you're doing something that you have guilt over. If you stole your dad's porno mag and used it as a teen boy, now you've got shame. And so these relationships are very complex. And I carried a personal shame for quite a while and guilt around the fact that when I was molested at 11 and I didn't say anything. So as an adult, looking back retrospectively, you live with the fact that all the boys that followed after you, and then the multi-generational impacts in some cases that you somehow were responsible for, right? And the shame was related to the fact that it was sexual abuse. And so they became very closely guarded and they were a deeper secret. So you start adding on these emotional connections to underlying trauma. And the more kind of emotional connections you have, the more of a secret it becomes. So there's shame, there was guilt, there was fear, there was anger. You name the litany of emotions that get attached to something that not only creates a trauma moment, but also steps over the moral line that you feel in society of acceptance, and you compound that secrecy. And then we look at today, you start to talk about the different ages. It's funny because the 70s and 80s and probably prior, one of the reasons there was probably more public, and right now I can't think of a time in history where there was more public shaming for things that you don't do right. So if your traumatic event happens to be in the public domain, you get to not only live it out in a public domain, but you get the shame of it. So I can only imagine the isolation that will bring men. And quite frankly, young men are isolating themselves at a rate that they've never done in the past. And it's because they don't want to be under that potential risk. Back in my day, if you will, you were just beaten. My parents didn't beat me, but a Catholic school upbringing, man, that the Baptists, the Catholics, the ones I grew up with that are my age, they talk about they just got beat, they got whipped. If you're on the hockey team, but you get whacked on the back every time you came off if you did bad on the shift. There was that through the 90s. I think there's a bit of a lost growth in there, but it's the segue to what we're living today. And it was the segue from an unacceptable level of, we'll just deal with it abruptly and hostily and maybe physically, whatever that step out of line was. And today, the passive aggressiveness and the shame via social acceptance or social ridicule is so heavy. So people have gotten out of that. There's no more physical punishment, but we're just going to talk you into the corner, into a point where you feel like the best thing you can do is just isolate, control your environment, and stay away from other people. It still brings you to the same conclusion, and that is that men get to bury their secrets because they feel this tremendous amount of guilt and shame, and it's applied by society. It's just applied differently today. Yeah. I think that the scary things is how isolated and how comfortable people are with that isolation of going into the internet, into social media. I'm going into and feeling somehow you're connected through this lovely medium that we're working on today, and neglecting the fact that personal touch, personal connection, in-person behaviors, we need those in a big way.
I think there's an awakening that's necessary because guys don't know what they don't know. And I posted a video recently on Instagram, and it was really just talking about how millennial guys, dads my generation, are all of a sudden being called to do things that previous generations were not expected or called to do. And the feedback that came was really interesting because people were like, well, isn't that just what women have been doing? Yes, for sure. But that doesn't discount the experience that men are now having, that there's
there's this extra layer and extra expectation for men, at least the ones who want to be a present father, to be a present partner, to be a provider, to do all of these things. And there's that expectation without the playbook or the manual on how to actually do that. We're looking at the picture on the side of the box, but we don't have any of the instructions on how to actually put it together. And now we're just staring at all the pieces on the floor, wondering how it's ever going to put itself together or how, if it ever will. And I think that looking to previous generations just doesn't quite, like we can't use that as the model anymore. Things have shifted and changed too much. And there needs to be a new ideal or a new model for guys to aspire to.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit. And respectfully, I completely understand and agree that the millennial wedge of men and the next generation, my kids' generation, 19, 22 years old in that range, the Ys or the Gen Zs are struggling a bit too. You don't have to imagine, you grew it. So you grew up in this educational system that everybody who attacks you in some way, shape or form is a bully. That's what you got to be trained. That was educational system programming. A generation of people that felt anytime that they were oppressed or anyone had a difference of opinion and came at them, that was categorized as bullying.
Along that thing was hard meant that you were not, like, if you didn't get it right away, you were not smart.
Right.
You were not capable or you were not good at that. And there was a judgment that didn't allow for work or effort or studying, or that if you studied and got good grades, you were still dumb. In order to be smart, you had to get good grades without the effort.
The realization later in life is that was a bill of goods. The smarter you are, the more didn't change necessarily the outcomes in the grown-up world. Kids, school, work, bills, taxes, all the things that surround us as adults. When we begin to be tax-paying adults with families, suddenly it's a big leveler. It's a big neutralizer, right? All of a sudden, all the wisdom that we had and going into a system that wasn't built to accommodate us isn't the one we thought we were going into. So my generation, the Generation Xers right now, are responsible for directing culture, shaping our ideas. The youngest version of the boomers as well. But let's say my generation now, and a Gen X, is a group of people who are supposed to be at the helm, shaping media, shaping entertainment. They own the businesses. And so they create the culture. And what we learned was the lessons of the boomer. And we were wanting and accepting to learn. Even as young men, we were like, F you. We know better. But reality set in and we went, oh, maybe there's some wisdom in what they went through. They were a baby boomer generation that were kids of people who were at war a great deal of their lives. And so maybe they have something of wisdom to share. And we went and we wanted to get that information. We didn't have it at our fingertips in the same way that people have had it in the last 20 years. And so we're here responsible for creating the culture and supporting it. And we're balancing that between that big work ethic, that get your ass in the work, do the thing, show the thing. I don't understand why no one's showing up in the office, all this pervasive. And then filter is, remember we talked about how you learn the shame and guilt. The punishment in the 80s and 70s was corporal. So it was really abrupt. And so maybe it's not physical today, but it is definitely verbal. And it's abrupt and it's very objective. It's not subjective. Conversely, this group that is young adults moving into, young adults, full grown adults moving into this environment and culture wasn't used to that. You mentioned about that work. Learn more, not rewarded for the hard work, rewarded for knowing more. And then everybody who talks to you is, if they disagree with you, they might be a bully. And so now you have a group of people who say, this is how we do it. And a group of people saying, wait a minute, don't talk to me like that. I wasn't ready for this. This is not the work ethic I grew up with. This is not the environment or the social construct that I was comfortable with. And by the way, you can't say that stuff because I'm far more in tune with what's going on from a diversity and equity inclusion level. And there's a huge gap there.
The challenge, though, Mike, is yes, 100%. We can't throw the baby without the bathwater. And we have to pull the wisdom from previous generations, or else it was all for naught. The missing link is that now there is an expectation, but I think it is created by social media, for men to put it all together. Whereas a lot of times there was the man who was successful in business, but his wife and his family hated him and he was overweight. But he was successful because he had his business. And then on the other side, you had people who were great at one lane. There were plenty. There are, of course, there are exceptions, but that's been the model, is that there was somebody who was the classic provider example. They went to work, they were home out of the house before the kids were awake. They got home at dinner time. They ate their dinner, kicked their boots up on the couch, watched TV for a couple hours, and then were at it again. And yes, they were providing, but then if you ask their kids, was their dad present? No. And so it's like they excel in these areas, and perhaps it's our own placing these expectations on ourselves. Maybe it's just me, but now there's the this ability to put it all together. And that has been the challenge. How do we have a thriving business, have a great relationship with our kids, be physically fit? How do we doing it all has been the challenge. And women are sitting there going, we've been trying to figure it out for whatever. But yes, give us your secrets.
I'm glad you said that, because I was just going to say, women have been saying that for the longest time. And what the realization is, you can have it all at the same time, it's impossible to have it all. And what right. I mean in that statement is, it's impossible to live up to the expectation that you can crush it on all levels. It is not impossible to decide or to expect that you can participate in that in various ways. It's funny, I was just doing my list of topics for the year for my men's group. And one of the end ones is about work-life. I never call it balance. I call it stability, because it doesn't exist. Work-life balance doesn't exist.
I like stability better than harmony. I've heard harmony, but I like stability.
Well, think about this. If you're trying to balance something, and if you're not putting something off balance, you're not progressing anywhere. All you're holding is the teeter-totter flat.
Right.
Something's not working. You're really not putting any effort in anything, and you're never going to get a perfect balance. Stability is about the ability to move within all aspects of your life and have that home base, that North Star, whatever you want to call it, where you come back to your core. So you always feel stable. And that's about how we perceive our place in the relationship between work and family, community, connections with others, how we position ourselves as men. Going back to some of the different generational pieces, just our different sense of where that was, it was very cut and dry before. In the 50s and 60s, baby boomers knew it was a provider role. It was that role you described. Read the paper out of the door, come back after work, close it down, do the same, rinse, repeat. Church on Sunday, that's what they did.
The other side of it is, okay, if you ask those kids, was their dad present? They'd say, no, not really. And if you ask that dad, were you happy? I don't know how many would say that they were like, oh, I find that a lot of those men were like bitter. And granted, they were doing their duty and doing their role. And once again, maybe happiness is not, and perhaps it shouldn't be our KPI that we're measuring for. But at least that's what it seems like today. You should be happy. You can be whatever. When you look at some of those guys who were just putting their head to the grindstone, I don't know how beat they were.
They don't misconstrue happiness and a lower stress environment. So they weren't living in some of the same stress that we've lived in for the last 20 or 30 years. They had an economic outlook that was positive. It didn't feel that they were constantly spinning their wheels in a financial sense. They had opportunities to have a house, buy affordable groceries, move freely back and forth to work at a reasonable cost. So they didn't have these pressures that surround what it means to be a family unit or a community member, the financial pressures and some of the lack of upward mobility that is believed to be in place today and is actually in place today. And if you're not walking around with those stresses, because that environmental stress takes its toll over time, you're now able to say, am I happy? When I am at home, am I happy? When I'm at work, am I happy? I would imagine that a lot of those men growing through those years felt quite happy, content, not longing so much for what they couldn't have or couldn't attain. The environment now is a lot different, right? It's very financially, very feasible for many people in many areas to acquire their first home without putting themselves in the poorhouse. By the time they get out of their student loan challenge, their home debt is the next one. It just feels like it's a perpetual treadmill that people are on. So they've got these external pressures coming at them, bombarding them in a way that they've never had. Maybe no other generation has had. At the same time, there's been no other generations as the recent ones that have been more prepared from an understanding of people, social acceptance, an acknowledgement of the world's a bigger place, that there's a wisdom that they have that a lot of people my generation before didn't have an understanding at 30, the same kind of knowledge base and how to navigate the world in the same way and gain that knowledge and gain that positioning. Every generation has its challenges. I don't know if today is any different fundamentally. I think at the core...
You know what I'm thinking as you're saying this, Mike, is like part of you, I think he's validating me and my experience here. But the other side of it is I'm really trying to think of why do we feel so blindsided? Which I talk a lot of context on this show and we talk a lot about the generational differences and things like that, because I found that it's like a matrix that people are living in. They don't realize they're living, or it's a lens or a perspective that they have over their face that they don't realize that they're living. They think everybody else is living from this same perspective that we've been given. And that's not the case. When you talk to people who came of age in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, there's some different mindsets that were shaped by the things that the events and the larger kind of circumstances that you're talking about. And I think that all that people my age, at least the smart ones, needed to hear was like, it's going to be hard. No one ever said that. Of course, it seemed obvious.
You did not get that guidance.
If you think back to the Generation Xers, that was built into the thing. It was like, rub some dirt on it. You scrape your knees, go outside, rub some dirt on it sort of thing. Whereas in the 90s, it was like, oh goodness, come sit over here. It was just a total coddling. And then we become adults and we're expecting that same coddling and life hits you and it's the furthest thing from it.
It's funny that you mentioned that because it conjures ideas even today where parents are engaging. You mentioned a 4 and a 5-year-old in your life. You don't source them for information about how their perspective will affect, like you don't ask them for their opinion on how to run the household. Okay. Pretty simple. How does that make you feel? Sure. Reasonable. It's sure better than shut up and don't cry for sure. But then tell me what you think. Let's get the opinion of the child who hasn't lived or been on this earth more than 5 years, which is difficult for the 20 plus person going into the work world. They expect the CEO, the executives to lean in and say, tell us how you feel about this company and tell us how to run it. And because they're going, we were told that we could do anything and we're knowledgeable. And you're like, here's the deal is you haven't put any kind of time in and it's not about earning your stripes. I've never been the one who suggested that the best way for everybody to go through life is to hit every pothole. I had mentors who thought that way and it sucked. Okay. Now it created some opportunities for me, but generally speaking, I could have used the time that I spent hitting every pothole with a few, hey, don't go in that one. I mentor in a way that says, I'm going to show you the potholes I know and some that are obvious that maybe you don't see, and you're going to hit your own. And I'm going to let you hit those ones. But let's just try to avoid this because why would you waste the time of your life doing that? So you think back to living a life where earned through pain, hitting every pothole, running in every wall was viewed as a valiant effort. And then people who later on in life went, that sucked. I didn't really think I had to work that hard to do that. So I'm not going to let my kids ever do that again. So then you remove all the barriers to your kids' pain and troubles. And then sometime along the way, they have their own pain and troubles because you're off on a cruise somewhere and your kids are in their 30s with their own kids and their own house and their own taxes. And they're going, wait a second, we're in our 30s and we never saw any of this pain. Why didn't you show us some of this? Why didn't you reveal that life was going to be a little bit more difficult?
Oh, I tell my mom all the time, you made growing up so cushy that now I'm dealing with some of the repercussions. And it's exactly that, though. I can't win because there really is. I don't know that there's a winning part of that, but it's that you need challenge. You need something hard to grow against.
And so Richard Reeves talks about this a lot. Another wonderful man, Frederick Marks, he was the director of Hoop Dreams back in the late 90s. And these gentlemen talk a lot about rites of passage and a number of other men. And I've really jumped on that train. One of the insular life, and I wouldn't say me, because the millennial generation lived a very insular life, as you described, free of all obstacles as much as possible and insulated from possible pain. Then there's this other new generation, Gen Zs, that are a little bit of both. I don't know if there's some backlash happening with them, but I'm not sure. We don't know where they are yet. And they're young still. They're still investigating their lives. There used to be a rite of passage as a man. And the heart of it in the early 1900s, it was you went to war right up until the mid 1900s, right? You went to war up until Vietnam. You went to war. That is a rite of passage of an 18 to 25 year old man in North America. And if you didn't, you were friends of someone who did, right? You knew someone. So the rite of passage was a brush with death. Prior to that, it was a warrior culture. Warrior culture all over the world have sent their young men out to battle or out to feed, to go hunt. And those things were to come back and provide. But in the process, those young virile men had life-threatening situations occur. When I went through that age, there wasn't a lot of threats to my life, but I was free enough that a lot of the things that are completely unacceptable now, I lived through. It was misbehavior, usually involved drinking, it usually involved driving, it usually involved partying, it usually fighting, whatever it was, not for me, but for a general group of men, it was a physical experience that was near death on occasion. And you look back fondly to those times going, boy, oh boy, I can't believe we did that. It could have been just out with your friends in the forest with a chainsaw. Or you're like, nowadays, how many opportunities do that exist? Does that come along for young men? You're not out there in the woods doing things. Like you're not out there risking your lives. Now, I don't even understand where a young man finds a rite of passage that puts their life to that that moment of risk that they move from that childhood into manhood because they somehow survived a test. And where those lie is, it's vague to me, not at least in North America. And so without those movements to manhood, you got to wait. If you're not getting it at 18 and 25, you're getting it in your 30s. And right. Your 30s is really family, financial, disillusion of relationship, whatever those hardships become, that becomes your rite of passage. And now you just pushed into your 30s instead of earlier on in life.
And I think you mentioned earlier, these experiences, they become, you know, they become formative, and we can't push them off as much as we think that we might be able to. They're going to come in our calling. We can only turn away the hero's journey for so long before that knock turns into a battering ram and it comes slamming through your door.
There's a generation of my age group that are having the bill of goods moments in their lives in the last few years where women are getting what they deserved all along, right? They're rising to the places that they should have been all along in the work world. And young men who, like you, like your generation, who are attentive fathers. And there wasn't a thing I didn't go to that my kids weren't involved in. That was one line I didn't ever blur. You're putting pressure on a generation that doesn't understand that. And we look back now going, we worked hard, we learned, we took all the courses, we invested our time and money, and it's not quite as rosy at 50 looking forward. Our retirement doesn't look the same as our parents' retirement. Our lives don't feel the same as that fulfilling life that some of those younger men are enjoying with their families, where they're in a unit where the husband and wife are committed to trying to do this as a group effort. And so we're sitting here, there's a large chunk of men 45 to 55 right now that are a bit lost. And they're a bit lost because they're stuck in the middle. The things that are on the extremes don't feel, look like their experience. They're not sure if they want to be in those things. And it feels like the world just passed you by a little bit. And those men are the ones making decisions at the helm. Those men who are confused about their position as male role models, as passing on a masculine message to boys, an understanding of our relationship with feminine and feminism, being in that role, knowing that we're leaders, that we must pass this on. We're challenged because it's all changing around us. And in that regard, you've got a challenge of the men. And this is where I spend a lot of my time, is trying to work with male leaders in roles that change, lead culture, own businesses, and create the opportunity for young men like you, young men like my son, to grow up into the world that they were taught exists without this stark reality that somehow it's different, that it isn't accepting, that it isn't culturally acceptable to share your feelings, that you can't just take paternity leave, right? Like all these things matter. And I'm trying to help men in my generation deal with the stuff that they bring from their youth and connected to the current life that they live, open up those doors, make it acceptable, say that we all have some challenges, that some of our stuff is worth dealing with, and it's simple and it's easier and it's not risky to do that. And there are treatments and therapies and non-therapies to do with this stuff. And if we just created a culture that men like you and younger boys like my son can move into comfortably without this conflict that somehow what you learned was wrong all along, then we might be able to make some headway, right? We might be able to change this intergenerational message of masculinity.
Mike, this has been a really good conversation. If people want to go deeper into your world, learn more about you, where's the best place to do that?
I hang out on LinkedIn, on my social media, pretty much. And unlimitedworth.org is my current movement, my project, everything that I'm leaning into with men and masculinity and trauma and healing and leadership. And that's unlimitedworth.org. That's where I'm investing my time and energy these days.
Wonderful. We'll link that up in the show notes. And I want to thank all of you listeners for being with us today and sticking with us. If you made it this far, we would love and appreciate a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know a guy who needs to hear this, hit the share button, send him a text, let him know that you were thinking about him or that this episode made you think of him. And as always, we appreciate being a part of the tribe. We'll see you on the next one. Later, y'all.